Welcome to Safe Radio, offering hope, health, and healing in these challenging times. My name is Ann Bergen, co-host of this series of programs, which are produced by my co-host, Jim Derrick, and brought to you by Franklin Radio. Jim came across Safe Coalition, a nonprofit grassroots organization, at its inception when he was lost and not knowing where to turn as he watched helplessly as his beautiful son descended into the hell of addiction. Jim became the president of Safe, whose mission is to provide resources, support, education for those living with substance misuse, domestic violence, other forms of addiction, all the outcomes of this mental health epidemic engulfing too many today. He now serves as the director of Safe's Family Support Program, recognizing that the disease of substance misuse impacts not only the individual, but all who love them. He learned the hard way with the best intentions of a loving dad, no matter how hard he tried to fix his son, that it wasn't Jim's journey. It was Jack's, his son's. Family members suffer often helplessly. Jim has made it his life's work to help grieving family members find their own sources of inner strength to deal with their own guilt, anger, fear, shame, and gut-wrenching pain that seems to go hand in hand with addiction. He lets them know, you are not alone. We can get through this together in the right way. I became involved with SAFE as a former public school educator as I read too many obituaries of my former students who lost their battles with substance misuse and were too often choosing to end their own lives when the pain of life became too much to bear. These obituaries keep popping up. As educators, we sometimes fail to see the fear and sadness that lives in the hearts of our students, the pain that is hidden behind anger, shyness, indifference, or words like, just leave me alone, get away from me. Jim and I invite guests to this program who agree to courageously share their stories and the wisdom gained from working through their own pain. They send a message to those who struggle with alcoholism, other destructive coping strategies. They say, we know where you are. We have been there. We know you are not weak, just lost. You are not alone. We will never let you be alone again. So, Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce our guest today.
Thank you, Ann, as always. And today in studio, we have a guest who is no stranger to me, just a terrific asset to the recovery community, and importantly, just a really, really good guy with a great story. His name is Bill Hawks, and Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
It is so good to have you. Bill, you are currently with RCA, Recovery Centers of America.
Correct.
And what is your responsibility with RCA?
So at RCA, I'm a treatment advocate. I cover Southeast Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and my job is just to connect people with the level of care that it is best for them.
You know, Ann, the reason I wanted to have Bill in is in part because of what he does, and we use Bill often. But more importantly to me is who Bill Hawks is,
right?
Because he brings, as I was saying off the air, his own personal passion for helping others in recovery. And that passion comes because, in part, you're a man living in long-term recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Well, and as I mentioned to you, when I call Bill with a potential someone that needs help from the SAFE Coalition, the differentiator with Bill is that he brings, as I mentioned, his passion and compassion to the call and never treats somebody as simply an RCA potential client. He's looking at the individual and with his knowledge, which is extensive, and we're going to talk more about Bill's networking and his ability to help others in the community beyond just treatment. I know that when I go to Bill, I'm getting somebody who really wants nothing but the best outcome for this individual, whether it involves RCA or not. And oftentimes it does. RCA is a wonderful facility. I cannot overstate how important that is to someone who is in our position at SAFE, because what you have is a partnership, one that is born out of the desire to do absolutely everything we can to give somebody that critical footing that they need to pursue their own recovery. And that's what we have in Bill.
Absolutely. And one of the things I know, because part of the way we're going to go is we want to hear Bill's story, because it's important that it's shared. And I kind of wanted to go back, maybe as we begin to tell the story, if we kind of start a little bit at the beginning, because for me as an educator, I just happened to be listening on YouTube to some people in AA telling their stories. And last night I happened to listen to this guy sharing his story, this man. And he said he first knew he was in kindergarten. And he was very anxious about going to school. And he said he was always never felt like enough, and he was anxious all the time. He knew right when the source of all this pain was starting. So I thought, oh, I've got to ask Bill as we get him to tell his story, because he obviously sharing the story helps everybody else to say, wait a minute, I've been where you are, and I'm here now. So I was wondering if, just to start, and then I know we'll go further about sharing your story, can you start about sort of your school experience and maybe some signs that came along that maybe it would be helpful for us to know so we can intervene earlier in the lives of people? Would you mind sharing that?
You know, I went to really small schools growing up. Back in the day, there was Leland Academy in Franklin. I went there. Then I transitioned to Mercy Mount, and our school class was 20 people. And for me, I always felt different. I never felt comfortable in my own skin, you know, and part of it is I'm a big guy. I'm, you know, in fifth grade, I was 6'4 and over 400 pounds. And one of the things that really disrupted my school, I was letting Ann know, is I couldn't sit in the desks. So I'd be leaving class, I'd be walking around.
Can you imagine that?
You know, I ended up getting horrible grades and getting in trouble due to my behavior, but I just was uncomfortable. And it was just, I had friends. I was able to kind of go into any social network. Like in high school, I was friends with the jocks. I was friends with the people that were partying. I was friends with, every different social network possible. But I never felt like I fit in with them, and I never felt like I had a real connection with everybody. So that feeling of apart was just really difficult. Growing up, too, where I lived was kind of isolated. There weren't kids in the neighborhood. It wasn't anything to do, so it was a lot of just alone time. And there was some different things going on, too. You know, I've got two brothers that are brain injured, so my brother had his first accident. My brother had his accident, and he's really disabled from that. And my other brother, he's brain injured as well, and so there was kind of always drama going on in the house just with them growing up. And then when I got into high school, going from that 20-person class into Franklin High School, where there's much, much more people, hundreds of people, was a big transition for me. And then freshman year, my father had passed away, and that's when I really started having substance abuse issues. I'd smoked marijuana before that, you know, just to fit in with the cool kids and hang out with them, and it gave me that release. It gave me that feeling of just being out of myself. It was the only time I could shut my brain off and not feel like, you know, uncomfortable in my own skin, because I wasn't present at all. So when my dad died, the doctor had prescribed me 4 milligrams of Xanax a day, which is a lot of benzodiazepines to be on for a 14-year-old. And then I went and continued school. And, you know, in school I was on benzo, so I wasn't performing well in school, but I was at least able to sit in the class because I wasn't present. I couldn't feel the uncomfortability. Then at 16, I had a back surgery, and I had multiple back surgeries that year, but the last one ended up with me having a wound vac in my back for 9 months. So we had to move my bedroom from the second floor to the first floor because I couldn't go upstairs, and I was in that bed for 9 months. They had me on OxyContin.
At 16.
They had me on the OxyContin. They had me on 10 milligram Valiums multiple times a day. And that was on top of the 4 milligrams of Xanax I was already prescribed. So I barely left that bed except to go to the bathroom. That was about it.
Great way to spend your teen years, huh? Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So 16 was a tough year. And it was the year I got my license. I had my vehicle in the driveway, and I'm looking at it. I can't even use it, you know. But I remember the nurse and the teacher. They had like a teaching aide that would come out, and a tutor to help me along with the school I was missing. Both of them said they couldn't really interact with me, that I was too medicated, that I was over-medicated. And the doctor just continued to write the prescriptions. Even after that 9 months, I was still getting prescriptions of painkillers. So at that point, you know, I was hooked to those medicines, physically dependent to them. So when it was time to come off, I had hung out with an older crowd, kids that were 4 years older than me. They were had graduated high school already. They were doing pills, and I needed to go to them to just not go through the withdrawals. There wasn't like a taper system. It was just one day I had all these prescriptions, one day I didn't, and then I had to go to the street and get the prescriptions that I needed to get through. So
and off you go, right?
Yep.
And listening to this, Bill, you're in your 30s.
Yep, 35.
35 years old. So this is 19 years ago. This was a time when everybody's familiar with Dope Sick, or if you're not, you need to look at the series on Hulu. But it was a time when, thanks to marketing of prescription opioids through a company called Purdue Pharma, really a criminal enterprise. But what was happening was like the perfect storm that you just described, where as an innocent 16-year-old, you're sitting there being fed these pills that are going to wind up addicting you. Mm-hmm. And for those of you that are listening that wonder how addiction starts, it doesn't always start this way. It most often starts with Bill's early childhood experience, which is feeling uncomfortable in one's own skin, whether it's anxiety and depression that relate. But who among us cannot feel an enormous amount of empathy and sympathy for this little boy who is literally becoming addicted to a substance that without a major intervention is nearly impossible to get off of?
Mm-hmm.
And that combined with you socializing with, just like any other kid, with these kids that are older, pills are popping around. And I know a lot of people in this town, in Franklin, that became addicted during this exact period of time, many of them being fed pills by people who would say things like, this is the magic bullet. It's not like drinking. You'll feel better the next day, with no knowledge, because the big pharma was telling people these weren't addictive, that they were relatively safe, and doctors were literally being marketed to and told to continue to prescribe them. So I wanted to take that detour, because for those that aren't familiar with this history, I'm sorry, but I'm going to use the word victim. There are a lot of victims in Bill's shoes.
And you mentioned that when you were in high school, because you were struggling with learning, because you weren't paying attention and you were in bed for all, then they put you in a special program, right? And that didn't help, really, did it?
No. So I ended up in the alternative learning program, which was downtown. And it was, I think, six or seven of us. So it was back to that small school vibe. But the problem was everyone that was there was on drugs. And there was, like I said, it was under 10 of us. And there were just multiple rooms. And it was kind of like almost working remotely. Like, you'd get handed a paper and just go into a room by yourself. There wasn't much supervision. So people were, you know, doing drugs right during class and in school, like in the middle of the place. And it was just, that was what it was. You know, our gym break was walking around downtown smoking cigarettes.
And to me, that's, you know, happily we're moving.
Yes,
we've moved
absolutely.
Way away from this now, but it was a warehousing of troubled, air quotes, kids. The K wing at the high school. My son was in the K wing, and the goal was to simply keep the line moving, get them out, you know, give them a D minus, get them the heck out. You know, there was no real intervention back then, right?
No. And it's funny that it was me and one other kid that were in that school that were there for medical reasons. We weren't there because we were the troubled students or anything like that.
Right.
But once I got there, I became that troubled student.
I want to remind you that we are speaking with Bill Hawks. Bill is in the recovery business with RCA, Recovery Centers of America, and also doing a lot of advocacy on his own. My name's Jim Derrick. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ann Bergen, and this is Safe Radio. You can hear us here every Tuesday at 102.9 WFPR, or if you want to pick up our past shows, go over to WFPR.fm, click on past shows, and you'll see a link to Safe Radio and all of our podcast episodes.
What I was going to ask then is also, now you're continuing your story, you're in high school, now it's time for graduation. What was the next step along in your journey and where this led you? Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So shockingly, I ended up getting off all the medications except for the Xanax. I was prescribed that, stayed on that. But I ended up working at a hospital as a security guard. And that was an amazing opportunity. I loved it. I was working doing that. I went to school to become an EMT at the same time. And then I also ended up getting a job at a police department as a dispatcher. So I was working for two different police departments. But at that point, I wasn't doing any, you know, narcotics or anything like that. And it was a great period of time. I bought my first house. I, for 6 years, was really stable.
Yeah.
You know, like, I bought my first house in, I think I was like maybe 19 or 20. I had a great car. I had a Harley Davidson. You know, I was engaged. Life was really pretty good until it wasn't. You know, I still didn't feel that comfortable in my own skin.
Right.
I would be going to these parties and I'd be sitting there with my career, not doing what everyone else was doing, just drinking. But everyone else was doing all the other stuff. But it's funny, I went from the narcotics when I went into that career field, it was the drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my addiction has been multiple different substances at multiple different times. I always tell people I'm not addicted to a certain substance. I'm addicted to the escape. I'm addicted to getting out of myself.
There you go.
So when I was working at the hospital, the emergency room nurses would have parties constantly. You know, we'd get off at 8 a.m. and we'd go for kegs and eggs and go drinking and get breakfast. And it was just kind of the culture. So I was drinking easily a handle of a day. I was drinking till I blacked out. I did that for a while. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, I ended up getting injured at the hospital and then back on the pills. So after that injury at the hospital, I had a patient, he stood up on the stretcher and jumped at me and twisted my back up, and they put me back on painkillers, and that kind of progressed into, again, the addiction. I ended up leaving that career field and just trying to get sober. Didn't work well.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to a facility and it was different back then. They would just kind of have you in for 3 days, put you on methadone and mm-hmm. kick you out to the methadone clinic. And so I tried that multiple times and it wasn't working. I ended up having some police intervention, which honestly was a blessing. And I was given the option after the police intervention to sit here and face consequences, or I could go to Georgia and attempt to get sober. So I left the state. I went to Georgia. I got sober. I went through a first responder program down there, which was interesting because unlike our first responder program at RCA, they had everyone just in general population. So they had a detective there that was there with someone he arrested, and it was they ended up getting in a fight and one of them leaving. But I went to Georgia, and that was the first time after multiple treatment facilities I got introduced to the program of AA, which is the program that works for me. There's multiple pathways. Everyone can find their own pathways.
Right.
And there's more popping up every day, which is amazing. But I got introduced to the big book down there. I got a sponsor, and I went to sober living. I just did the whole continuum of care. And I was sober for a couple of years and did fantastic. While I was there, I met my first wife, and Atlanta ended up getting stale. It had a great recovery community. Atlanta has a crazy recovery community. They have clubhouses like that Bellingham Clubhouse everywhere.
Clubhouse, yeah.
Everywhere. And their clubhouses would have like 6 meeting rooms. They'd have a kitchen. They'd have basketball courts. It was just incredible how advanced their recovery is. I ended up meeting my first wife, and like I said, Atlanta got a little stale, so I moved to Dallas, and at that point, I got into sales. I was talking to Ann earlier. I got into, my first job was being a national account manager for T-Mobile, and it was great, you know, but the problem is I became addicted to the money and addicted to that lifestyle of the hustle. After that, I ended up working for multiple other companies. I was a regional manager. I was over Texas, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey. So I was traveling a ton.
Were you maintaining your sobriety during all of this?
At that point, yes.
Yes. Okay. So you're in the program. You're hustling along here.
Yep.
Okay.
And traveling all over the place. But that's when everything kind of took a turn. I was traveling all over the place, uncomfortable in my own skin
still,
because I got disconnected from the program from traveling. And I should have been going to meetings while traveling, because you can travel and stay sober. I do it now. But I should have been going to meetings. I should have been calling people. I should have been working with sponsees. But instead, I was just traveling and then isolating in my bedroom, the hotel room. So I ended up having my first child, Olivia, and we ended up at that point again with the traveling. I ended up starting to drink again. So I was drinking while traveling, and it just was a really bad situation. I got to that point where it was every single day a whole bottle a day, blacking out, throwing up, and it was just mundane every single day. I went back to treatment in Georgia, got sober again. I actually stayed in Georgia for a little while. We stayed with my first wife's parents, and I worked out there for the same company that I was working for. They were really great. They were amazingly supportive. They knew what was going on, and they wanted me to get the correct help for it, and they even created a position for me to be able to make the same money and stay in Georgia.
Wow.
They were amazing. And I owe my old vice president a lot of, because without him, I don't know if I'd A, be alive, but definitely he gave me a lot of opportunities to get sober and stay sober. After being in Georgia for probably about 10 months, I think, we ended up relocating back to Texas. Worked for the same company for a while. We had our second daughter, Harper. And then I ended up relapsing again. So it was the same situation. Go to Georgia quick, get patched up, come back, get back to work. I worked for, at that point, transitioned to working for Google and was the territory sales manager for Google. And I was, again, doing a bunch of traveling, loving the lifestyle, huge event shows and stuff like that. But I felt so guilty leaving my kids. I still felt uncomfortable, and I wasn't, I was working a program in the beginning of it, but towards the end I had some issues. There was some issues with our marriage. We ended up taking a little separation. I also was told that I had probably had lung cancer. They found a bunch of nodules in my lungs, and they told me a little ahead of time they should have done more testing. But for 3 months, I was convinced that I had lung cancer because that's what they told me. I went to multiple specialists. I was at UT Southwestern, and they ended up doing the biopsy. The next time I went back, they did a scan and everything was gone. So that was a huge relief. But the problem is, when I got that news, I went and got benzos. I went to the doctor. She had no problem writing me a prescription of benzos. She put me on 4 milligrams of Xanax and 4 milligrams of Klonopin a day. I don't know how I functioned during that time. So I did that for a while. And then eventually with the benzos, I ended up transitioning to a stimulant because I needed something to keep me awake because I was asleep all the time. And I was just right back in the horrible spot that I was in my early 20s. And it was just a very difficult period. And we ended up finalizing and going through a divorce. She moved back to Georgia with the kids. I came up here to get sober, and it took a while for me to get sober. I was sitting here. I was so guilty for not having my kids with me. I was so guilty for not being with them. I was ashamed. I was just filled with remorse. I felt horrible, and I felt like I was never going to see my kids again. I had no hope at all for anything. I had no hope. The only thing that really kept me alive was my family being there and offering support all the time. They wouldn't give me financial support. They weren't paying me to go get drugs. They weren't giving me money. They weren't doing anything, but they made sure I was fed. They made sure I was, you know, knew that they cared and stuff like that. And between them and then someone that works for a great nonprofit in Massachusetts calling me every day, at the worst timing, she would call. I'd be drinking, get a phone call in the middle of the night. Hey, I've got a bed. Are you ready? Get a phone call in the early morning. Hey, I've got a bed. Are you ready? Just checking in too, just calling and saying, hey, how are you doing today? It was weird. Someone cared more than I cared about myself at that point. And I've told Jim before, you know, my mom finding recovery was one of the biggest detriments to my addiction. So my mom finding recovery is what killed my addiction. She learned how to set proper boundaries. She learned not to give me the money. She learned, hey, if he's unhoused, he's unhoused. I became homeless for the first time in my life. I was used to, since I was 18, making a six-figure salary, and I was homeless. I had nothing. I lost my car. And she sat up worried at night about me and all of that, but she found peace and found recovery through going to groups like Learn to Cope, going to groups like Al-Anon. She had an Al-Anon sponsor. She worked the Al-Anon steps. And it, like I said, it just absolutely killed my addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I make sure to do when I'm working with a patient. The second I get that phone call, if they give me permission, I get the family involved.
Yeah.
Wow, Bill. That is, there's so much to talk about there, but wow, thank you so much for your vulnerability and sharing that story. And you can go right straight line from that young man that couldn't fit in a school desk, right? All the way through this addiction. And there's so much there. First and foremost, which paramount to me, is that Bill, you are an incredibly hard worker. You are incredibly resourceful. I mean, here's a young man that bought a house.
Yeah.
13 years before I ever bought a house or even could even think about it. Here's someone who gets these jobs and performs well. So you're an achiever.
Mm-hmm.
Underneath all of that is this feeling you don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that one set. So for anybody that thinks that being an addiction is about partying, partying's in the rearview mirror. That was done with the kegs and eggs, right? Yeah. I mean, that you're not partying when you're functioning as an addict, are you?
No.
This isn't fun for you.
No, my mind tells me it is, though.
Yeah.
So my mind will sit there and tell me, oh, that one time in 2006 that you were able to have two drinks and leave the bar, and it was such a good experience, and you were playing darts with all your friends. It will remind me of that. But it forgets to tell me all the times that I was ending up on the streets, that I was begging the person to front me something, going into a liquor store $2 short and seeing if I could just get something from him. It forgets to tell me all that stuff.
And the other thing about your story, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so stop me anytime, but I heard you say that while you were introduced to the big book and to the program, the 12-step program of AA, that your priorities got out of line and you went and put your recovery, said, well, that's done. Now I'm going to move on to work. And again, it's that outside in thinking. If I can make the buck, then I'll be okay. I'll feel better inside. And so you kind of left that spiritual journey of the 12 steps to the side for a little bit, right?
I put two things in front of my program. It was my job and my kids. I said, oh, my kids are going to keep me sober. That's fine. You know, how could I use if I've got kids? And I've learned through getting the lumps on the head that if you put that whole saying, if you put anything in front of your recovery, you're going to lose it.
Yeah.
And now that's how I live. I put my recovery absolutely paramount, absolutely first in my life. Every day I start with my recovery.
Mm.
And then I go out and do the work I do, which is awesome, but and live the life I live. And I've got a fantastic life. But if I don't put the recovery first, I'm going to lose it all.
For sure. And you know, I know Chris Sullivan sat right where you are, the former Patriot player who played on some Super Bowl teams, and he talks to kids, and oftentimes he'll have his chip in his hand that he got from AA that he earned, his sobriety chip, in his Super Bowl ring. He'll pass that Super Bowl ring out and let kids handle it, and he says, if they lose it, they lose it.
Mm-hmm.
He won't let anyone touch that chip
because
recovery comes first, and I love your witness to that. And there it is.
There it is.
He's letting me hold it, which means I have a significant amount of trust. But this is a beautiful ring from AA celebrating another milestone.
Yep.
And I love that, Bill. I love that about you. And then the final thing that you talked about, which is so important for us to hear, is that your family's recovery was paramount and critical in snuffing out your addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And for all those families that are listening out there, that is what we do at SAFE. My job as director of family services, family support, and central to that is what Bill said. So oftentimes we will take a lateral from Bill, who's working with the addict, or from some other person that's working with the addicted loved one. And the lateral is, now let's get the family involved. And families need to hear that it is critically important for you to pursue your own recovery. Mm-hmm. So when I first heard that, full disclosure, I thought, what do you mean my recovery? It sounded almost offensive. My goal was to fix my son, who's battling a potentially fatal illness here. Stop talking to me about me. And what you just heard right from Bill was, no, it's a family affair. Mm. That so what are the principles we learn as a family? We learn to set boundaries, as Bill just mentioned. We learn how to cope with our emotions, because through this, of course, setting a boundary, when you tell your loved one they can't come home, there's a tremendous anxiety, fear, guilt, shame, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so we work with families to manage those emotions so that when their loved one is ready to pursue recovery, mm-hmm. they're still sane. They know right. how to cope with someone in recovery so that they're not hovering over them and imposing, you know, their will on that other person. It's complex, but I just want to make sure that people know how important it is that they get in. And I do want to give our phone number. It's 508-488-8105. That's the Safe Coalition support line. You can call anytime. And if you're a family member or somebody who would like to pursue their own recovery for addiction, please give us a call, 508-488-8105, and we would love to chat with you.
Can I ask, I was going to ask what, just the more interviews we do, the more we learn, the more I learn about the power of AA. Mm-hmm. Can I ask what you drew you to that? What makes that work for you? Why is that the path you've chosen?
So when I was in Atlanta, I had my first sponsor. This guy, Kenny, is absolutely amazing. He would pick us up every day. I didn't have a vehicle out there. I had nothing to my name. He would pick us up every day. He would take us to a meeting. I lived with, I was in a sober living house, and they do sober living differently down mm-hmm. there. But he would pick us up every day. He would take us to a meeting, and then afterwards he would take us all to dinner every night. There'd be wow. three of us every night without fail. He sponsored the three of us. Once a week, we'd sit down. I'd sit one-on-one with him. We'd go through the big book. Mm-hmm. And that love, that just compassion and mm-hmm. that desire to be of service was so comforting and so intriguing that, you know, it was just like something I got hooked on immediately. And I really dove all into it. Like, I love the history of AA. I love the program of AA. I love the 12 steps. I love the 12 traditions. I love the 12 concepts. And I'm actively involved in all of that. And it's funny, my sponsor today is one of my old sponsors, and he's still in Atlanta. So it's funny, I work with him. We have a meeting every week on Wednesday where all of his sponsees, all of our sponsees, anyone in the family, in our lineage, meets on that meeting. And then there's multiple meetings throughout the week virtually that we do. And then I have a home group that I do out here as well. But it was just, that was a big piece of it. And when I read the book, it made sense. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy that a book that was written in 1930s makes sense to me, you know. And I know there was a period where AA was like, oh, we're for alcohol only, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's really changing, and it's becoming a lot more progressive and adding a lot more people into it and being more inclusive. And, you know, reading Bill's story, it made sense. I could relate to Bill's story, especially, you know, the job, the traveling the country, sure. the this, the that. And then the doctor's opinion, where it breaks down those four people, I was able to see myself in all four of those things. So I knew I had an issue at that point. But it was just an awesome book that somehow made total sense to me. And to a lot of people, it still makes sense.
And importantly, you knew you weren't alone.
Yeah.
I hear the fellowship being the driving force here, right? And I do want folks to know that Bill makes a beautiful point. Great segue. Families Anonymous, which is a meeting that happens every Tuesday night at the Safe Coalition offices, 6:30 to 8 o'clock. For families, we use the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as our solution, and it hasn't been rewritten. We use the exact text, and we follow the same 12 steps that Bill's talking about. In our case, I'm powerless over my thinking, and as a result, my life has become chaotic and unmanageable. That's step one, right? And the rest of it is a design for living, which is specified in the book. It is not about drugs and alcohol. It is about a spiritual solution to chaotic thinking.
And that's what I wanted to ask this question about, because, like you said, just reading it now from the 19, you know, it's so relevant, but it's relevant for everybody. Mm-hmm. And the question I was going to ask, because one of the most powerful parts, which is backed up by neuroscience, is this whole idea of connecting with sort of a higher power or that inner source that everybody has. We all have it in us. It's connecting to us. That's a source of a lot of peace and all of that. I was just curious about how you have found the way to connect to that, like that higher power. Is it through meditation? Is it through prayer? How is it that you have been able to, in that step of AA, how have you been able to do that? Because to me, it's one of the most powerful parts of AA that would be useful to everybody. Can you just share that part of it, connecting to that higher power?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had a period where I didn't believe in any sort of higher power. I was raised Roman Catholic, went to Catholic schools, everything like that. But between the death of my father, my brother's two issues, my mom having breast cancer twice, it was just like, how is there something up there, you know? And working with the sponsor, I went and I researched a lot of different higher powers. I went to a Hindu temple. I went to a Buddhist temple. I talked with a Catholic priest. I talked to a couple ministers. And in the end, I just knew there was something bigger than myself. These coincidences were happening and lining up. You know, just even getting a bed when you need a bed for recovery, like that's higher power working. There's no coincidences in life, in my opinion. So that was a really big part of it. And also with that whole attraction to AA, they were like the main original provider of the 12 steps, you know? And it's funny, everyone, like you mentioned, uses their book, Heroin Anonymous, Crystal Meth Anonymous.
Of course.
A lot of them, they just use the same book. So it's something that clearly works. That's one of the biggest attractions for me.
It saved me.
Yeah.
And it saved me from the chaotic thinking that came along with being a dad in this. So what a powerful witness. Bill, I want to talk a little bit, and with your permission, about Bill Hawks now and what it is that motivates you to be so involved and how you are involved right now in broader recovery efforts. We talk about RCA, and RCA has been a wonderful vehicle for you. But could you just give us a window into your dedication to helping others now in recovery?
Yeah. Just to touch on RCA a little bit, the reason I'm so attracted and love working there is because we work ethically, and we want to help every single person. That's the goal at RCA, which is just incredible. That's kind of the mission. Our mission is to save 1 million lives. You know, that's our mission. And we work hard on that every day. We also, with the family services, we do free interventions. We do family counseling. We do all the things that help the family get introduced. We have family groups, all that stuff. So they get introduced to their own recovery and they have a better idea what the addict's going through. And that's one of the biggest things that drives me is I work today for a couple of reasons. One, as a living amends to my mother. Right. I put her through hell. So I work really hard with families. I always try to get them involved in the beginning of the process if the patient allows it. And then two, it's what keeps me sober. It's what keeps me, you know, feeling comfortable in my own skin. It's what keeps me going. So I work also with a nonprofit down on Cape Cod, One Shared Spirit. It's a recovery center, and I'm on the board there and assistant director of peer support, and we do a lot of great work there. And, you know, it's just an amazing facility as well. And that, coupled with my program, I'm able to sit there and also do service to my program. I'm working to get into the jails committee. So it's just another service position because the program's about unity, service, and fellowship. Mm-hmm. That's the three pillars of it.
Bill, when I meet people that come in for the first time, family members, their number one goal is how, and why wouldn't it be, how can I fix my loved one? Mm-hmm. There must be some recovery program out there that has better success than anyone. I want them just to go there and that'll be the end of it. For me, the biggest confusion with all of that, when as a parent that entered the system that way, was at the time I thought that like any other illness, you could just put them at Dana-Farber, you could put them at juvenile diabetes, you know, and the doctors, the white coats will take care of it. They'll come up with a solution. How is addiction recovery different than that model?
There's so many options, and it's really custom tailored for every patient. I mean, there's options where you are able to work while you're going through treatment. There's options now where you're able to do, you know, outpatient and sit there and attempt that way. And then, of course, there's the inpatient options. There's not really one program that's the best, you know, like it's different for every person.
There is the willingness. Mm-hmm. When you have someone who has cancer or somebody who has diabetes, usually you have a patient that says, sure, I'll do whatever they tell me to do.
Right.
Yeah.
With addiction, and you mentioned this before, it's a disease that tells you you can handle it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You just had a bad day the day before. So a disease that tells you you're not sick, right?
Yep.
And what I try to let parents know is that it's a long haul, and the likelihood that the recovery of their loved one is going to involve them in any way is low. Mm-hmm. Parents can't cause them to want to have that willingness.
Yeah, parents didn't create the issue and they can't control it. The number one thing the parent can do is get in recovery themselves and learn those boundaries and, you know, be able and better equipped to deal with their child.
When you finally, you had to make that decision, you know, was it because that person was calling you and saying, are you ready? Are you ready? What do you remember when finally you said, I've had enough?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
I do. Yeah. It was a really profound moment. I was using a lot of substances and I had a lot left to go. I could have kept going for another day and a half off of what I had. Drinking multiple substances, just a complete polysubstance situation. And I was living in a sober house. And I called the sober house manager and I said, this is what I've been doing all night. I'm not at the house and I'm not going back to the house until the morning to get my stuff. And he said, you know, go to treatment. You can come back. I called my mom and I said, I'm done. I waited till the morning so she would be awake. I called her. I said, I'm done. Can you come pick me up? And she picked me up. She took me to the treatment center. I ended up getting kicked out of the treatment center. And I never used again. And it's funny because with my addiction, I sat there and I had those substances still in my possession, basically, for the next probably 30 to 60 days. But I just didn't have any desire to do them. And I finally got rid of them. And I've never picked up since.
You said they kicked you out of the treatment center. Yep. And then you stopped?
I stopped just that morning. I just stopped and I had plenty of substances to go. There was something that
just said, I've had enough.
Yeah.
But it had to come from you, right?
Yeah.
Right. Wow.
A powerful, powerful story. Bill, to give you the model of what we do with Bill, oftentimes I'll get calls from people that are looking for assistance in navigating treatment options for their, and I make one call to Bill. Yeah. And as I said to the last individual you helped and their family, by the way, who are eternally grateful, had a wonderful outcome. I said, look, this is an advocate. He's going to get you pointed in the right direction. And there's one thing I can promise you. He will call you back. He will be very thorough. He will point you in the right direction and he will remain available for as long as it takes, for as long as you want him to be. I cannot tell you. Based on what Bill just said, his emotional story about getting this call from a nonprofit recovery assistant, you know, outreach person who just kept offering, not lecturing, offering.
When you're ready.
The door was open, the door is open, the door is open. And now Bill is paying that forward professionally. And it's just, as I said to you, it's so heartwarming to me. And it's why I love the recovery community. Because the cornerstone of the recovery community is being of service.
That's it,
And Bill is such a great example of that. I do want to give out a couple of resources. First of all, of course, you can call the SAFE Coalition support line with any question at all relative to mental health, substance abuse. You don't have to know you want to come in that day. It's all anonymous and it's free. All of our services are 100% free. And our number is 508-488-8105. You will get a call back within 48 hours of your call, and we will be more than happy to help you. We can help you with collaborating care so that you can organize a treatment that you may want to pursue. Bill is certainly a part of our team in doing that, and we can help you there. We can also help on the family side, and I am the Director of Family Support, Jim Derrick. Call and just let me know you'd like to chat, and I can talk you through the various support styles that we have, including our 12-step program, which happens every Tuesday night at 6:30 at the SAFE Coalition offices. But as Bill critically said earlier, one treatment modality isn't perfect for everybody. I've met people that don't want anything to do with the 12 steps, but they thrive at Learn to Cope, which is another great partner of ours, where Learn to Cope provides a different type of style meeting. So just like with any recovery, there are multiple ways to go through it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and at RCA, it's funny, we have, what makes us different is we have one person that teaches the 12 steps of AA, NA, Celebrate Recovery, Smart Recovery, Refuge. They're starting up with that. And that's all he does. So when they have an objection, God, stuff like that, he'll sit down and talk to them. Mm-hmm. And RCA is the only program I've ever seen. And this is one of, again, reasons I love it. We give the patient, when they walk in the door, a 12-step study guide. and they get taken through that 12-step study guide in 30 days. So instead of just handing the kid that's been in detox the longest and has 5 days a big book and saying, run a meeting, they're actually learning that it's a program of action. They learn and get introduced to the actual work of the program, which is huge and just a huge asset. They get that. They get the first 30-day journal and the first 90-day journal. And the 90-day journal gets followed with the alumni team. It's got questions, prompts, journaling things, little games in it.
Wow. What I love about that is you got the person at the height of their interest in recovery,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's an opportunity. But you're not just letting them sit there and have all these, like, nobody does well when they don't know, they don't understand what it is they're pursuing. So you're saying we're giving them that understanding, giving them the tools right up front.
Yep.
Not going to keep this a secret. I love that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Have you heard of Back to Basics, the Big Book program?
Yep. It's basically based off Wally P's Back to Basics.
Okay, great. Yep. There's a great text out there, Back to Basics. We just started employing it for families.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, do you want to give out some phone numbers? Or?
Yeah. So two quick things. One
Please.
Is that we do offer mental health services. We have a Section 35 unit for people that have to go that route so that mm-hmm. people aren't going to jail. And it's a good diversion so they're not ending up in Framingham State or in, God forbid, a jail. They're in somewhere that they can get treated with dignity. And one of the biggest programs that I really love is that we have a first responder program. And it's a segregated first responder program. So you're not with people that you've arrested. You're not with people that you've treated in the community. It's for anyone. Police, fire, EMS, corrections, and crisis healthcare workers. I was lucky enough, like I said, to go through some first responder programs in my life, and having that is just huge for them to have the anonymity and have the ability to recover. And it's just a great opportunity. And the other thing that we just launched last year is we do have a co-occurring program. So if there's someone that has dual diagnosis, they're suffering with some mental health issues, they come in, they're able to meet with the psych team, they get followed really closely, they get a lot of extra support and services, and they get their medication straightened out while they're in with us. And of course, my phone number is 774-269-8176.
774-269-8176. And that is Bill Hawkes, H-A-W-K-E-S. And you can always call us, our support line, and we will put you in touch with him. I am so grateful for you, Bill, for your story, for your vulnerability and sharing. And full disclosure, I am a huge fan of Bill's mom, who I met many, many years ago, and I love her dearly. This stuff works. Recovery works.
Yeah, it does.
And
it works because of people
woman.
Like you. So
yeah,
I'm so grateful. It's such a pleasure to really meet you and talk with you, and it's great.
Thank you guys for having me.
Well, thank you, Bill. And so for our guest, Bill Hawkes, and my co-host, Dr. Ann Bergen, my name's Jim Derrick, saying thanks for listening to Safe Radio, and we will see you next week.